Hey, it's Andrew Siciliano. Trey Hendrickson got his deal done. Terry McLaurin got his deal done. When is Micah Parsons' deal going to get done? Plus, what's the real story in Cleveland? All of that coming up inside coverage. The preseason is over. Mercifully. Time now for the regular season. Eventually. In between, we have this 1 week with the cutdown day looming on Tuesday. Welcome to Inside Coverage, everybody. My name is Andrew Siciliano. We are here at 6:30 Eastern Time, Monday through Thursday. It is the how and why, everything going on to the National Football League. You could watch on YouTube. You could watch on the brand new Yahoo Sports Network, which is new, as mentioned, and streaming. It's on a fast channel, free advertising supported TV. You know, like all the free channels in your smart TV, hit that button. You could find them. Find us. You could also find us streaming 24/7 on yahoosports.tv, this show and all the Yahoo shows. Go there. Find us. We appreciate it in advance. I also appreciate these two gentlemen who joined me on this show today and will throughout the week as well. Frank Schwab in front of a massive map of Denver. Charles Robinson in front of a massive map, I believe, of Dallas. I think Houston. I got the state
Odessa,
right.
Austin. Who knows?
Austin. I'd prefer Austin over Houston and Dallas. No offense to either. Gentlemen. It's good to see you both. Hopefully you had a fantastic end to your preseason.
It just seemed like the fire hose turned on over the last few days, doesn't it? We went from like, okay, the preseason. And now as we're getting ready for the show today, there's so much to talk about. There's so much that has happened in the last 72 hours or so. It really feels like the season's upon us.
We burned through all the who's not going to play, who's not going to sign. Who's going to be out for a week? And we just da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then what always happens is push comes to shove. There's 13, 12 days left to get into practice and get it done, and everybody starts to get it done. But there is still a holdout that I'm sure we'll be
except
talking
Dallas.
About today.
Except Dallas.
Right. Dallas, we'll get to that in a second. But before we do, I should also point out, everyone should read Frank's column. Not that they shouldn't read Charles, but Frank did a great piece Saturday night. Basically, everything you need to know from each of the preseason games. Frank, thank you. That helped me out big time.
I watched the preseason, so you don't have to. That's my role.
Right. During the preseason. I was at a game, and I watched plenty of games leading up to the game that I was at. We'll talk about it coming up shortly, the Rams Frank. And the Browns in Cleveland. But all the other games that I couldn't watch were the ones that I was bouncing around on the plane, on the flight home, trying to watch live. Frank sums it up for you. It's beautiful. So go check it out. And while you go look for it, let us give you the news today. 4 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesday is the cutdown deadline. And teams have started trimming their rosters. Some that played on Thursday started doing it Friday morning. At 4 p.m., you got to be from 90 down to 53. Players have to go through waivers. Not everyone does. Vested veterans. We'll get to that in a second. Let's get to the news, however, in the last couple of hours. Earlier this morning, Terry McLaurin got his deal done. Within the last hour, Trey Hendrickson got his deal done as well. Let's start with Trey, because Charles, he didn't want to play on $14 million, which is what was left on his contract. He's led the NFL, right. Hendrickson has, in sacks in each of the past two seasons, cumulatively about 37 of those. And I thought that he might be the Carson Palmer guy, the guy that just went home and said, I'm not going to do it. What it looks like here happened is that both sides win to a degree. They give him a bump up to $30 million, so he gets his big paycheck this year. There's no guarantees beyond that. And unless the Bengals use the franchise tag next year, Trey Hendrickson can hit free agency come March.
Right. Well, look, first and foremost, I was going to get this dig in. We now all know that Frank is now sending gifts to Andrew to get that very generous bump of Frank Schwab content.
Yeah, Frank, I don't know what your contract situation is. I hope they don't tag you. Hope you get a new deal.
Hey, I didn't get $30 million this year.
Yeah, it's not quite a Trey Hendrickson type gift that he got from the Bengals, but I know Frank's padding the expense sheet and sending that Andrew's way. Anyway, look, to get to the Bengals, so there were two ways. From what I was told, there were two ways to break the dam here for the Bengals as they approach the final 2 weeks before the season kicked off. And that was either Trey Hendrickson, they could offer Trey Hendrickson a heavily but reachable incentive-laden deal that could potentially get him to near the $40 million mark. Or they could just straight up say, look, we'll give you $14 million on top of this. We'll get you to 30, and that money you're going to get. You don't got to worry about earning it. Obviously, anytime anything's incentive-laden, you get hurt, and those incentives go out the window. So you take the $14 million, you get to 30. He still has one incentive in there. It's multiple triggers that could bump him an extra $1 million. For the Bengals, I mean, it gets it done. This is the happy medium or the unhappy medium that often happens between teams and players. The Bengals don't get control of him. Obviously, we'll see if the tag comes into play. But to me, from everything I understand right now, part of what's built into this is that they're preparing for Trey Hendrickson to go and test free agency and get that contract that he wants next offseason. And I think both sides are happily unhappy. He gets the bump ultimately that he wanted, and we'll find out a year from now if he can land that $40 million plus payday he wanted.
Yeah, I'm surprised actually that it got done. I thought the Bengals were going to sit on this for a while. You said at the jump, and you're right that usually this stuff gets worked out. But in this sense, I was like, I don't think the Bengals are going to cave here, but they kind of did. You're Trey Hendrickson, you got to realize, I don't really have a lot of leverage. They ain't going to trade me, and they're willing to be stubborn about this and just sit on this. So to get, like you said, all the way up from 14 to 30, I thought was pretty good for him. And he can hit free agency. Yes, he's going to be 31, but if he plays again like he did the last couple of years, there will be a pretty good market for him still, even at his age. So
yep.
I do think it's a win-win. The Bengals get their guy in the camp. Now their defense can have some hope of being a playoff-level unit to help that offense out. And Trey Hendrickson gets a really, really nice pay bump when he honestly didn't have a ton of leverage. So it kind of worked out how it should have worked out, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I think, Charles, you summed it up well, that both sides agree to be happy but unhappy here a little bit. Right? The Bengals stick to their line, which is we never like to guarantee anything beyond 1 year, and here it's going to be $30 million. What's interesting here is the franchise tag. You said the assumption here is they won't use the tag. But if that isn't in writing, and hypothetically the Bengals do use the tag, which right now is projected at like 26 to 27 million, the franchise tag was never intended to be placed on a player at a number lower than the number he just played for. So if the Bengals were to use that tag, it's basically 2 years and 57. But the 2026 salary would be less than the 30 he is due to make now. Charles, can you remember a time where that ever happened?
No. I mean, it's certainly unusual. And again, as you said, if something isn't in writing, I don't think we can necessarily guarantee it. But I can tell you there's no way on Trey Hendrickson's end of it, I cannot believe that there were not assurances made that, listen, come in, take the $30 million. You're not going to get to 40. We feel like it's a heck of a bump, even though, you know, $30 million amongst the elite pass rushers, considering, you know, this is one of the best edge players in the game the last several seasons. He falls pretty far behind the elites at the position still, even at $30 million. But I believe the trade-off has to be, you're going to have your opportunity, you know, to go out there. We're not going to put this tag on you ultimately. But again, until I know that's in writing, and as of right now, you know, pressing up against 7 o'clock Eastern on Monday, I don't know that that's in writing. I haven't seen anywhere. I haven't heard it anywhere that's in writing. So it's still something that potentially is on the table. And I cannot recall the last time a player would exit a salary and then go into a tag situation where they were making less money.
Yeah, that it's the devil's always in the details with these deals. You got to wait until you actually see the paper and the contract filed with the NFLPA. And the same goes, honestly, for the Terry McLaurin deal. Let's get to that one. On a personal note, I've made it clear that I thought Terry McLaurin should be paid. I'm happy for him. I grew up in Northern Virginia, right down the street from where the Commanders trained. And this guy has been the bridge from dark, dark years under previous ownership to now. Fans coming back to this franchise and Jaden Daniels leading this franchise to the postseason. I've said that regardless of age, I think Terry McLaurin deserves some hazard pay, some combat pay, and I'm happy this deal got done. But when I heard that the deal was 3 years and $96 million, Charles, my immediate reaction is, no, it isn't. There's no way.
Yeah, right.
There's no right. way that this is – well, I'd love to see the two-year guarantee. Is this a one-year Band-Aid at 32, or is this a two-year guarantee for, say, 58 or 59 or 57, something in that window, with a funny money year three that's never going to be realized?
Right. The key phrase here is up to. It's up to $96 yes. million, dollars, which tells you right away, okay, there's some attic in there that has yet to be explored as far as what we don't know about. From talking to people in the franchise, though, I can tell you this. There was a feeling, and I believe this is where it will come into play if it ultimately is a two-year deal. The belief inside the franchise was, look, when we get to the point where there's $50 to $60 million guaranteed on the table for Terry, we think that that deal gets done. And now that the deal is done, that is what I believe ultimately we will see. Because for Terry McLaurin, if you take what is ultimately a one-year deal, if it's a funky three-year deal with, a trap door after 1 year, that doesn't help him. That's not really helpful once you're in your 30th year as a wide receiver. You don't really want to be hitting free agency, heading into, hey, I'll be 31 in 2026. Let's do a deal for me now. 2 years of guaranteed money, though, is a big difference. So I think if they fall in that bracket that the Washington Commanders were comfortable with, which was $50 to $60 million over a two-year span, that's ultimately what will get this done. And the sense that I got, from them, from the sides when I went through and spent some time with the Commanders, was that If the Commanders could get up in that range, $27, $28, $29 million in real money, and McLaurin was willing to move down off of that, DK Metcalf $33 million annual average value, once the two sides came together, it was going to end up looking like about $30 million a season with that, bracketed $50 to $60 million in guarantees. We have yet to see the numbers, but I would be surprised if it's not really a 2 year deal that, as you said, Andrew, is around $30 million a year.
Yeah, Andrew kind of touched on this, and it's rare to see a player holding out or holding in this case. And pretty much 100% of people are like, why aren't you paying Terry McLaurin? Always somebody out there that's like, oh, this greedy guy, he's under contract. Terry McLaurin has 100% approval rating because I think everybody realizes, like you said, Andrew, he was a bridge. He played with, I think, 11 starting quarterbacks before Jaden Daniels. And then the list of those names is pretty awful. And all of the investigations and the name changes of the team and all of the dark stuff with the Commanders, he was kind of the symbol of hope, of a guy who just was a great soldier through the years. That's the guy you want to pay, a team captain. His popularity among the fan base says a lot about Terry McLaurin. It always seemed like this was going to get done. It's just, at what point does either side blink? Could they come to an agreement that everybody's okay with? This was it. I'm very happy for Terry McLaurin, like everybody in the world is. Like, he is one of those guys you want to pay. You want to show your locker room, hey, this guy went through it. Right. Like, there were some dark, dark times with this franchise, and we're going to take care of you. It might take a while, but we're eventually going to take care of you.
And by the way, guys,
go ahead.
Necessary too, because, I'm telling you, standing there in camp, I'm sitting there and I'm standing in camp and I'm like, okay, how much does Zach Ertz have left? Like, come on, at some point there has to be a drop off here at this age for Zach Ertz. I looked at Ben Sinnott. They're not getting almost anything out of Ben Sinnott. Like, there's like, I'm standing there going, man, like, are we sure this guy's going to make the roster this year? He's basically the third tight end. You spend a high pick on him last year as a rookie and he doesn't do anything. Luke McCaffrey, I think, has been, disappointing to a degree for the Washington Commanders. And so all of a sudden you're standing there and you're going, okay, we hope Noah Brown's healthy. you just don't have a lot on the table. And McLaurin was far and away, Jaden Daniels' number one guy last year. So it wasn't hard for fans, as Frank said, to be on that side of the ledger when it came to this one, because they were looking at everything else and saying, where are we throwing the ball if we're not throwing it to Terry McLaurin?
Yeah, he might not be one of the top five number ones or even the top 10 number ones in the NFL. I think he could be top 10. but he's your number one and you need him, and Jaden Daniels needs him, so you got to get him paid. Want to quickly touch on Brian Robinson here. That trade became official. He goes to San Francisco, where Kyle Shanahan late Saturday evening said he expects Robinson to be the number two behind Christian McCaffrey. Today, Robinson on the practice field says he thinks they can be the best 1-2 punch in the NFL. So that trade is officially final, and the 49ers get a back. And here is images, moving pictures of Brian Robinson doing push-ups in Santa Clara, proof that he is a San Francisco 49er, who, by the way, they already have a ridiculously, almost a comically long list of injuries at skill position. Not only running back, but a wide receiver as well. The Juwan Jennings thing is weird. Is it a calf? Is it a contract? Is it both? Still no movement there. And we're getting closer and closer to week number one. I also kind of wonder aloud, why wouldn't the Texans make a move for Brian Robinson? Maybe they did, and the 49ers simply paid more. Let's get to Houston's running back situation, guys, because this took a turn today. We haven't seen Joe Mixon all of training camp. He has this NFI, meaning a non-football injury designation on a foot and ankle situation. He really didn't do much of anything in the offseason program. And today the Texans announced, after DeMeco Ryans deflected all questions this morning on the podium about Joe Mixon, the Texans announced he is done for the first 4 weeks of the year. They're going to put him on basically regular season NFI. And if you could read the fine print on the screen, that's what it says. After week four, maybe he can practice, maybe he can play again. Charles, there are almost no details on this. Yeah. And right now it's Nick Chubb and Woody Marks and Dario Ogunbowale, who for most of his career has been a third down back and a core special teams guy. And this is a team with legitimate playoff aspirations.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to tell you right now, I live here in Houston, and this has been completely opaque. Like, there's just been no information, nothing leaking out. They've kept it very, very much under wraps in terms of what is the nature of the injury and how did the injury occur? And that was up until now. Now that he goes on the NFI, you're like, okay, there's a backstory here. Something clearly here occurred. Yeah. And not only that, in the announcement, it feels open-ended, as in, like, we'll see. You know, maybe after 4 weeks, we have Joe Mixon. Maybe we don't. Maybe Nick Chubb and Damian Pierce pick up the slack. And we feel good in this situation. And maybe Joe Mixon is not a Houston Texan after week four of the regular season. It's very, very interesting how this has unfolded, but it's certainly given life to two players in Chubb and Pierce who, you know, look, injuries aside, when both players played at their best, remember, Damian Pierce is still 25, by the way. We're very tough runners, very powerful runners, can be healthy. I think a very capable 1-2 punch, you know, for the Texans. But this is quite a turn for Mixon, because I can tell you, in the franchise prior to this, they were in love with him as a player. They were in love with, you know, how the mentality he brought, the physical style of a runner he was. He was a guy who could play through some pain. But whatever, you know, the foot injury ultimately is, it sounds pretty serious.
And when you start thinking about the Houston Texans, this is one of the reasons I'm down on them this coming into this year. Defense is going to be good. We know that. CJ Stroud's awesome. Nico Collins awesome. Let's look at the rest of the offense real quick. Worst offensive line in football. The running back room might be the second worst in football behind Cowboys. What are you guys doing? The receiving room is really, really young. Jaden Higgins is probably going to be a good player. Yeah. I don't know that I want him as my number two right now. Christian Kirk, yeah, he's had his moments, but Jacksonville just gave him away in a trade. This offense is pretty thin. And if something happens to Nico, it is really, really thin. Now, you're right, Charles. Maybe Damian Pierce, Nick Chubb did play well in the preseason after reports on him in camp were kind of mixed. Woody Marks, they did trade a future pick to go up and get him. So maybe he's a thing, especially as a pass catcher. But overall, I don't know. This Houston offense, it could crater pretty fast, especially if something happens to Nico Collins, who might have 200 targets this year because there's just not much else going on there.
With the new offensive coordinator, remember Bobby Slowick has moved on, and now Nick Caley is the OC, who is last two years actually was the Rams tight end coach. So he moves in there. Yet another John Carroll grad working for the Houston Texans. But what is he working with? He's working with Nick Chubb, and as Team Nick Chubb right here, I hope, really, like, I am rooting for him to get back to form. Everybody is. And if there's any like sliver of hope here, people say, oh, Nick Chubb wasn't the same. He was getting there when he got hurt. And the injury wasn't a knee. It was a foot. It was a non-contact foot injury, not something dramatic, not like rebuilding his knee like he had to do after the injury in Pittsburgh a couple of weeks ago or a couple of years ago. I beg your pardon. I hope Nick Chubb can get there. But, you know, that is a big if. Also a big if coming up on Inside Coverage. If Micah Parsons is there week one in Philadelphia, the latest from Dallas after Micah was laying down on the job on Friday. Frank, Charles, I'm Andrew. Don't go anywhere. Terry McLaurin got done. Trey Hendrickson got done. Now there is only one hold-in left standing. Or, Frank Schwab, Charles Robinson, one hold-in left on his back, maybe. That is the better way to say it. As Micah Parsons was the only Cowboy on the sideline Friday in their preseason finale that did not have a jersey on. To quote my man Warren Sapp, you act so tough, you act so tough. Put a jersey on. Put a jersey on. But Micah Parsons did not. And briefly, he was seen on the broadcast, on his back, on the training table. This is after being seen entering AT&T Stadium with a giant plate of nachos. Just who wants processed cheese before a game? That's just me. Now,
me.
When asked after the game, what's the deal with this? Was he sleeping? What is going on? Brian Schottenheimer basically pulled Dave Wannstedt and said, I have to go back and watch the film. I don't know what you're talking about here. Let me see. And Mike Leslie, the man who first put these images up, said, hey, just so you know, this wasn't the entire game. And Micah thanked him for a little bit of an explainer. But as we sit here, guys, 9 days before the Cowboys get on a plane and go to Philadelphia for the opener, there is still no deal. And while Schottenheimer says he's confident a deal is going to get done, and Dak Prescott said the same thing today, he is confident a deal is going to get done. I mean, what else do you want Dak to say? Yes, he has confidence. Charles, there is still no deal. And Jerry Jones is still spinning like these old folksy, like mama and daddy kind of stories, good cop, bad cop. Like, Charles, what actually are we doing here?
I there's so many ways we can go here at this point. I mean, every time Jerry talks now, I feel like we're like the dogs that hear a whistle. We're just like, what? Like, you turn our heads like, I don't know if I understand what's going on. I can tell you this. There was a missed marketing opportunity for Micah there. Like, you walk in with some like Wetzel's pretzels, maybe some Auntie Anne's. You make sure people see the snack bag that you're holding as you walk in. Like, there's no way this is not personal now. You could not convince me that this is not a
personal.
100% personal. You could not convince me this is not a reply shot to Jerry going on Michael Irvin's podcast and saying, well, we sent the details over to David Mulugeta, and he told us to stick it up our bleep. Okay, so now Micah's like, all right, I'm going to roll in. I'm going to know cameras are there. Wait for me to get in here.
I love what he do, Jerry. It's great.
He's walking in. He's got his nachos. Someone says, come to Atlanta. He says, hey, man, you know, make the call. Puts up the little phone sign next to his head. Then he's laying on, you know, the table during the game. It's not Antonio Brown stripping his jersey off and running into the end zone during the game, waving goodbye to his career. But he knew what he was doing, right? Like, there's absolutely no question about this in my mind, that this was a response to Jerry, what I think was crossing a line and putting out a very personal detail about the negotiation, which is not the Cowboys' style. They've gone through tough negotiations in the past with different agents. You know, the Todd France negotiation with Dak Prescott twice was extremely difficult. Never got to the point where they're like, well, this exact thing was communicated between the two sides in a way that would make the agent look bad, right? So to me, I think the reason why people should be alarmed here is we've moved to the point where Jerry is now publicly lobbying with fans over how this has all played out and basically pointing at the agent and saying, blame that guy. And now Micah is saying, what am I doing here? What are we doing here? This is how I'm going to show you. I have discontent, and this is where we're taking this. All bad, I think, for the Cowboys and Micah.
Yeah, Micah's a very smart, very media savvy guy, and he knows exactly how it looks when he's digging a plate of nachos into the game and laying on the table and all that. It is becoming so personal. And even today, I mean, a little bit ago, Darrell Revis, who might be trying to position himself to be a big timer in the NFLPA, puts out a statement saying the union's nowhere to be found on this. Dallas is trying to go around. It's getting so messy on every single possible angle. That's why I ask you, Charles, being seriously, how does this get done? Like, at what point, like, I don't think it's realistic anymore for Jerry to just give in and just be like, all right, this is how much money you wanted here. Well, I can't do the Jerry voice as well as you. And Micah can't give in now. How does this get done? Like, what has to happen for this realistically? There's a reason McLaurin and Hendrickson got done today. You need to get this done if you want to be there week one. And Dallas has four fewer days than those teams.
And there were times when you talk about the McLaurin negotiation, it was not clean. There was some acrimony there, but they never let it get out to the point where it was the owner / GM literally taking an open shot at an agent in where? In a very friendly podcast with Michael Irvin, who's not going to shoot back at Jerry and go, well, Jerry, why are you trying to do the deal with the player anyway? Like, why would you not have, this is the number one agent
it's
in the
so
game.
Out of
how
line.
Could you expect?
It's so bad.
Jerry waited until he was perfectly protected. He took the shot he wanted to take. And as you said, Frank, now that's the red line moment, because I'm like, okay, Jerry is now publicly and repeatedly trying to lobby to Cowboys fans saying, I'm not the problem here. I've offered Micah the richest contract. That's not a quarterback deal. And this is what the agent ultimately did when we were ready to put this thing to bed. That's unambiguous. And now Micah is on the flip side of this. He's gone from, I'm not saying anything. Okay, well, you're not saying anything, but you are saying something now. Now you're saying something. What? And guess who else got put in the middle? Schottenheimer is now in the... Brian Schottenheimer has to address this. Dak Prescott's got to address this. All these other people have to address this. This is, man, I'm telling you, it went from, yeah, it feels like this is something's going to get done, to now I'm back to where I'm like, he might miss some games here. Like, this is getting to the point where it's almost nasty.
At least week one, it's 9 days away, 10 days away. Come on.
I mean, even if he's up and running,
even if he signs tomorrow, like, it's
right, and it's a road game. Yeah,
easy.
It's a road game.
I would ask you, Andrew, like, you know, when anytime, and teams all factor this in when they're getting deals done, they all go, hey, look, if we're getting a deal done, we know bare minimum to make sure we're not putting a player out there and getting them hurt. We need 2 weeks, maybe 10 days, like a 10-day to 14-day window to try and get that player at least up to speed where we could potentially get him on the field. But even if we do, it's going to be in a limited fashion. So even the Cowboys at this point have to know, well, we're up against it. Like, he's not running out there and playing a full game against the Philadelphia Eagles, and the next thing we know, he's got a hamstring problem and he's shelved for, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. So, like,
can
Andrew,
we throw something else in here? It's a new DC. Matt Eberflus takes over. It's a new system. I mean, there's so many layers here. Let's go back to the agent thing. There's nothing wrong with players representing themselves. The problem here is that David Mulugeta represents Micah Parsons. He is his registered agent, and Micah is not running from that. Bobby Wagner, for example. Love Bobby Wagner.
Sure.
Richard Sherman, another former Seahawk. They have negotiated deals on their own, and that's fine. That's not what this is. If, by chance, Jerry and Micah had a deal that Micah is satisfied with, Micah felt that they had a handshake, and Micah was cool with it, he would tell his agent, I'm good. Let's do the deal. Yep. Let's do the numbers, if it truly did happen that way, that Jerry and I allegedly agreed to. But that hasn't happened. Any attorney, and I've spoken to attorneys who are just football fans and have no knowledge of how the CBA works in the NFL, any attorney would tell you that if you have an agent and you work something out with your employer, the agent still has to paper the deal. You can't just skip that step over and send the numbers into the union and say, this is a contract. So yeah. I don't get what Jerry's doing here. I was binging the Netflix America's Team doc last night, and there are so many parallels here with the animosity with Emmitt Smith after the Cowboys' first Super Bowl win. Emmitt's working out on his own in Florida. All the Dallas TV news crews go there, and like Emmitt's on camera in this thing going, hey, Jerry, let's do a deal. Call me. That footage then gets flown back to Dallas and played on the local news, but then they're hugging it out and smiling and laughing when they finally do have that press conference. You think that day is going to come? And look, they buried the hatchet. They went in. They went on to go back to the promised land and Hall of Fame, and they're still there. Maybe they get there here, but this one feels, in this day and age with social media and 24-hour coverage, a lot, Frank, a lot angrier.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jerry Jones is completely at fault here. He knows better. He's a great businessman. Great. I have a lot of respect for Jerry Jones, actually, as a businessman. And I think he's a lot sharper than a lot of people give him credit for. Obviously, he's super smart. He knows better.
Absolutely.
If a Lamar Jackson wants to negotiate his own deal, cool. That's great. But if you have an agent, you can't skip that. Charles, maybe you have an example. I don't know of any other guy who has an agent who skipped the agent in negotiating. Like, it just does not happen. So for Jerry to kind of be aligning this whole, like, it's the agent's fault because I had a deal done. I don't know. Like Andrew said, what are you doing here, Jerry? Like, literally know better. And I think even fans know
better.
The agent
works for the player.
This isn't how it does not, that's not how the business works. And he knows that.
And guys, it'd be one thing if the Cowboys didn't have a history of trying to do this with their players. They have a history of doing this with elite players. Agents have complained about it repeatedly. Micah has repeatedly made it known, I want to do this through my agent, David Mulugeta, which of course you do because you're about to sign the richest non-quarterback contract in league history. If you have one cut at the plate, you go and get Aaron Judge, okay? That is who David Mulugeta is. Yep. And what happened? Jerry threw it his head. So now how do you get yourself out of this when there's two guys, David Mulugeta, Jerry, what happened clearly was Jerry got insulted when he felt like he did a deal. And David Mulugeta said, I haven't negotiated this deal. Don't send me details. That pissed Jerry Jones off. So what did Jerry Jones eventually do? He went out and aired it all out because his feelings were clearly hurt when that ultimately unfolded the way that it did. And we got to where we are right now with Micah. But the bottom line is you cannot deny a player's right to go hire the very best representation to go out and maximize what their value is on the field.
Or the very worst representation. Either way, the guy's got an attorney, and he's registered with the league absolutely. And the union as his attorney. That's it.
Yeah, there's no... okay, so let me ask you this. How do you... Knowing the egos and the pride and the hurt feelings that clearly are out there now, how do we all get out of this?
Charles. I don't know. I don't know how you meant this. I really don't. Jerry Jones at some point is going to have to pick up the phone and call David Mulugeta. There's no way around this, but I don't know when that thaws. I can't fit. That's why I kind of asked you, because I'm like, all right, in any other deal, you're kind of like the two sides. Okay, he wants 43. He wants 41. We'll stop at 40. This is different to me.
The number's 45.
Both sides
by
are
the way,
so dug in and they're so stubborn that this isn't a money deal anymore.
Yeah.
Who knows? All right. Well, clock is ticking. The opener is 10 days away. The Cowboys fly to Philadelphia. By the way, Micah Parsons from Pennsylvania. Like, I mean, there's so many layers here. We'll keep an eye on it. Stay tuned. Moving on. Let's go to Vegas. So there are a lot of moving parts here in Vegas as we get towards the cutdown deadline, 4 p.m. Eastern time, 1 o'clock Vegas time. Calibrate your watches coming up on Tuesday. First of all, Aiden O'Connell has a wrist injury. He was scheduled to be the number two quarterback behind Geno Smith. He's out 6 weeks, 8 weeks. Pete Carroll made it very clear yesterday the Raiders are looking for an experienced quarterback somewhere. There are plenty of them out there, but that's not the big story. The story also today is that Jakobi Meyers, veteran receiver, who was a great bargain deal and a part of the talent drain off Bill Belichick's roster late in his tenure in New England, would like a raise. He's due to make roughly $11 million this year, and he'd like a trade if he doesn't get that raise. Ian Rappaport says that he went in there and said, trade me. And then about an hour later, we get the news that Amari Cooper is back, one of the biggest name free agents still out there. In name, not necessarily in production last year. The Browns were able to flip him after a disappointing start to Buffalo last year for a third round pick. He didn't really do much in Buffalo, had 40 some catches between the Browns and the Bills. Charles, what's your read on the Raiders after a surprising post-camp Amari Cooper signing?
100% giving themselves options if they feel like Jacoby Myers is, if that's going to be a problem. Like, I think they have no issues whatsoever with Jacoby Myers being an individual that they jettison off the roster. I mean, we've seen it in this preseason already. We've seen them move off of, you know, Christian Wilkins. I mean, it was a huge, you know, move for them. And when I went through camp and you talk to people who comprise the brain trust here, what they will tell you first and foremost is you better be here to play football. You better be here to get with the program. And if you have a complaint when it comes to your contract, I think in their minds, there's a way to work through that. But if you're going to come in and demand a trade, we're going to give ourselves the options to go ahead and fulfill that need and trade you if we ultimately have to do that. I don't think that's what the Raiders want to do. You know, I think they want to continue to give Geno Smith as many options as at the table as possible. And Jacoby Myers is certainly that. And I will say this for Myers. He is underpaid for the production he puts on the field. Basically, you know, that kind of money is very, very low tier number two receiver money. And he is a better player than that, or at least he historically has been a better player than that. But the new Raiders regime is not sticking with guys that were not necessarily their decisions, you know, to bring in the past. So I think the Cooper signing is absolutely to give themselves a tool on the table to go, if he's not going to be here, if this is going to be some kind of issue where games are missed, or we just feel like we need to move off of him because he's not with our culture, we can do that now.
Yeah, I'm always for players getting paid. And if Jacoby Myers gets a raise out of this, good for him. And he did have a good year, 1,000-yard season last year. But I don't think this is going to work out how Jacoby thinks it's going to work out. They're like, okay, fine. We'll get Amari Cooper. We drafted Dante Thornton, who looks awesome, by the way. He looks really good for a rookie. Also, Jack Besh, who hasn't done much, but was a second-round pick. And they're like, Brock Bowers is our number one receiver anyway. So we really don't need you, Jacoby. Sorry, but you can play for your $11 million or sit out. What do you want to do? It's because any team who's going to trade for Jacoby Myers is going to have to pay him and make him happy. And I don't really know that there's that kind of market for Jacoby Myers. So, hey, if Jacoby gets his raise, hats off, I'd be impressed. But I think the Amari signing was, hey, Jacoby, the train's going to leave with or without you. Whether you want to be on board or not is up to you.
Yeah, there are plenty of teams out there that could use a veteran wide receiver right now. There are plenty of teams with injuries or teams that have realized that the rookies or the younger players on the roster are not yet ready truly for prime time. And that's the most interesting thing for me about cutdown day. It's the trading of the veteran pieces, whether it's, you know, the Eagles getting Fred Johnson back or the Chiefs getting Derek Nnamdi back. Hey, don't cut that guy. Let me give you a 7, a 6, a late round pick swap, in essence, a case of beer for a player that I don't now have to compete on the waiver wire to reacquire. Jacoby Myers is a veteran receiver where if he's happy with $1 million or $2 million bump, something where I don't have to give him a long-term contract or one that I'm not truly locked into, he might interest some teams out there that are in need of a veteran receiver. There's some of the AFC North. There's some of the NFC West. I mean, there are plenty out there, but again, it's a matter of money. And at this point, how many dollars are you going to commit to a player that just got there? Or would you be happier with cheaper options on your roster? That is always part of the math right now as these teams go through the waiver wire or look at veteran pieces that are available. Speaking of the waiver wire, coming up next, we'll explain how it all works tomorrow and tell you about a Sanders that has already been released. And somehow, this made national news. All of that coming up next on Inside Coverage. Wow. It's Inside Coverage here on Yahoo. Frank Schwab, Charles Robinson. My name is Andrew Siciliano. This is the how and why of any and everything you need to know around the National Football League, live at 6:30 Eastern Time, Monday through Thursday, on the brand new Fast Channel for Yahoo. Check it out, everybody, on your smart TV or right here on YouTube, among other places. 4 o'clock Tuesday, cut down day, 90 down to 53. Plenty of teams have already begun trimming their rosters. Let's talk about the quarterback situations. We know now the Saints have yet to name a starter as we sit here. Kellen Moore says it's close. Rattler and Tyler Shuck, he's going to figure it out. Meantime, in Cleveland, last week, Joe Flacco was named the starter. We still don't know the rest of the quarterback depth chart. However, Andrew Berry, the Browns GM, went on the local News 5 Cleveland TV broadcast on Saturday. Browns beat the Rams, and they go to 3-0 in the preseason. And Andrew Berry was asked by a friend of the program, Chris Rose, would you keep four? And he said yes, he would keep four quarterbacks. And he said the Browns view it as an opportunity rather, and I'm paraphrasing, rather than a burden. Right? Hey, we have four quarterbacks. We like them all. We're going to keep all four of them. The next day after the game, Kevin Stefanski said that he thinks Kenny Pickett, who, in my opinion, probably would have been the day one starter if not for the hamstring injury, could be ready to go for the Bengals opener on September 7th. And this is me surmising here. If that's the case, he's probably the number two quarterback. Where does that leave the rookies, guys? Well, Dylan Gabriel played really well. He played really, really well in the preseason finale, and he made a claim if Pickett isn't healthy, or maybe even if he is, that he should be the number two quarterback. I'm guessing he's three. Just one man's opinion. Shedeur Sanders did not play well. He took five sacks. He was 3 of 6 for 14 yards. And as good as he looked week one against Carolina is kind of how bad he looked week three. Plenty of factors here. Obviously, people have pointed out online that four of the five old linemen he played with have already been released. Well, there was some overlap with Dylan Gabriel's group as well. Three of the five old linemen that Dylan Gabriel played with have also been released. I was watching Get Up this morning, gentlemen, and Mike Greenberg, another friend of the program, respect him greatly, started the Shedeur Sanders conversation by saying, guys, it's almost too ridiculous to talk about. I don't know why we're talking about, but it is that ridiculous. We are going to talk about it. Shedeur Sanders didn't play in the final drive for a litany of reasons, none of which are conspiratorial. Tyler Huntley is one of Kevin Stefanski's favorite players. He told me and others before the game that he would like to get him into that game. He made him a solo captain for the third consecutive week. And there is another issue here at play, and that is the Browns have a kicking issue. Frank and Charles, Dustin Hopkins was so good in 2023. He got an extension, and he wasn't good last year, and he hasn't been good in the preseason this year. The Browns kind of needed to see Andre Schmidt kick a game winner. And Tyler Huntley was a better bet to get them into position to see Andre Schmidt kick that game winner. There are so many factors here at play. There is no crazy backstory for Shedeur Sanders. He's the fourth quarterback and a work in progress.
I mean, can we just agree that now we have seen we've gotten both ends, right, of the spectrum. We've seen
correct.
Him comfortable and looking good and, you know, playing with some rhythm and some confidence, and which, by the way, probably wasn't the best he could play. But it brought us all a little closer. We leaned in on Shedeur Sanders when he played.
All rookies have good moments and bad. We've seen him.
Absolutely. There's unquestionably. Now this, you know, a game like this where you see the five sacks, he illustrated clearly what was the downside of his draft profile. Hey, he'll drift in the pocket. He'll hold the ball too long. I mean, there were how many snaps did he hold the ball? 5 to 6 seconds. You can't do that on the NFL level, right? When you're trying to navigate out of a sack, you never turn your back to the defensive line, right? You don't put yourself in a position where you're staring backward at your own end zone to try and eventually get yourself out of a sack. That's how you get murdered. It's just questionable decisions and him being able to get away with some things athletically at Colorado and sometimes not get away with them, but doing them anyway and taking on those sacks. And so I think we saw the opposite end of the spectrum. We saw the downside. But as Andrew said, it's unfortunate that we have gotten to the point with Shedeur that his backers have really, they've like reached a peak of like, they're like, it's like Jonestown here, where the second something isn't going right with Shedeur, they're trying to force someone to drink the Kool-Aid because it's, you know, it's not Shadur's fault. Like, it's just, this is, we got to get past this now. And it's unfortunate to see Kevin Stefanski get asked questions about, you know, this, the whole conspiratorial bent of like, are, you know, like sabotaging this guy or not, regardless of whether or not fans are talking about it. And I, you know, I spoke to an executive this morning who caught that clip on one of the morning shows and has known Stefanski over the years and thinks a lot of Stefanski, both as a coach and as a leader. And I mean, he just straight up said, and this was his opinion, not Kevin's, he's not speaking for Kevin, but his personally knowing Kevin, he was like, I mean, for, I wish Kevin, you know, could get out of there basically. Like, I'm not going to say exactly what he told me, but he was like, I wish, like, if this is how he's going to get treated in this scenario with a fifth round pick, who's your fourth quarterback, and you're going to have to deal with this on a week in, week out basis. The fans there don't know what they have in Kevin Stefanski, or at least the ones that have piled behind Shedeur.
It's funny to me that the one logical voice over the weekend was actually Shedeur Sanders. He went on Instagram and was like, hey, preseason was a lot of ups, lots of downs, but I'm going to work to get better day by day, rep by rep. I'll get there. I was like, wow, everybody else is freaking out with the conspiracy theories and the rage videos and the Robert Griffin III coming out and saying he's not even being allowed to compete with Dylan Gabriel. Like, well, Dylan Gabriel's drafted two rounds ahead of him. Robert, you know how the NFL works. You were drafted ahead of Kirk Cousins. Like, this is draft that just tells you how a team thought of Dylan Gabriel. They like Dylan Gabriel more than Shedeur Sanders. Shedeur Sanders struggled as a fifth-round pick. A fourth string quarterback. That's very normal as a rookie. This wasn't crazy. Like, they called plays to make sure no, it's just a fifth round pick struggled at quarterback after having a good game in an opener. That's going to happen to rookies, especially lower round rookies. And what this has done, and Andrew, I'm glad you brought up Dylan Gabriel. Dylan Gabriel's a pretty awesome story going on right now. He's a third round pick who, physically, you know, I mean, he dropped a little bit in the draft because he's not 6'4", and he doesn't have a cannon arm. He's played so well that you're like, the Browns might have hit on something here. They might have their number two quarterback, and given Joe Flacco's age and what the Browns start might look like, Dylan Gabriel might be starting by Halloween if he is their number two guy, and nobody's talking about it. Nobody's giving him any respect. Nobody's giving him any credit, where the Cleveland Browns hitting on a third round quarterback should be a big deal. And I'm sure the Browns are really excited about Dylan Gabriel, and nobody's talking about him. And that's just weird. The whole situation's been odd, but I just want to give Dylan Gabriel some credit because he's looked really good this preseason. I didn't expect him to look this good, but he has.
Well said. He looked really good. And for the record, and this goes, like I mentioned, the O-lineman cut, obviously. You guys know this. Other than, look, the Browns played their starters for three series. For the most part, Flacco got three series. But a long list of NFL teams won't play anyone of any significance that will be needed week one in the final preseason
game. Of course.
So the idea that rookie backup quarterbacks would be playing with O-linemen that are going to get cut is not breaking news. Guys,
it's like, logic.
I don't know that the Rams in that game put anybody on the field that was making the team. Like, I mean that. Like Tanner Engel.
I think you're right.
Like there are a couple of guys. Right, Terrence Ferguson, obviously second round pick. That was his first action. He played because he had been nursing a hammy and hadn't done anything through camp. The Rams fielded a team of guys that are all getting cut. All of them. Now, many of them are going to the practice squad. But they're all getting cut. It's just the way it is, and they knew that. So take the third preseason game for what it is. You had rookies doing their best and young players trying to do their best. All right, meantime, Shiloh Sanders was released. Let's put that narrative to bed as well. He didn't get released because he threw a punch at Zach Davidson on Saturday evening and subsequently got ejected. But we can say, however, that if you're an undrafted rookie free agent playing deep into a final preseason game and you throw a punch, it certainly doesn't help your case. Found it interesting. It was on like CBS this morning today, like that kind of news. Shiloh, by all accounts, good kid, heard nothing but good things, and hopefully he is back on the practice squad as well. He was just one of a number of moves already made by all 32 teams. And just so everyone at home knows, and you guys, obviously, Frank and Charles, you know this as well, there's always this thought, well, hey, can I get this player through waivers, right? We really like this player. Can I cut him? And can I get him to the practice squad? Or will another team claim him? The waiver order right now for the first 3 weeks of the season is the inverse order of finish from a year ago. So basically the top of the draft, not including trades. So Tennessee's got the first claim, then the Browns have the second claim, and the Giants, the Patriots, the Jags, the Raiders, so on and so forth. Charles, it kind of surprised me today when I dug up the numbers. Last year, there were only 27 players claimed on waivers immediately after cutdown day. So that's like less than 3%. And seven of those 27 were claimed by the Panthers. So while I think Jackson Meeks had a heck of a camp for the Lions, the rookie out of Syracuse, if somebody wants to claim him, they have to put him on their active 53-man roster. And like, there aren't a lot of players that were claimed right after the deadline last year that did anything for the teams that took them.
Yeah, and look, I'm going to tell you right now, if your team puts in a lot of waiver claims, you should be worried because
Tennessee's going to put in a lot of claims, and they should. But
absolutely,
you should be worried.
What it means, people should understand what happens is your personnel department, it sits there and it does a numbers game and it says, here's this group of players, here's our roster. How many of these players are better, or do we assess as better than the ones we current? Can we upgrade by putting in claims on these guys? So if your team is claiming 6, 7, 8 players, it means the bottom of your roster is pretty weak. It means, or at least far weaker than other teams across the league, because you're effectively trying to swap it out like a bad hand of, you know, poker, right? Give me 4. No, fold. You don't ask for 4. the one thing I will tell you too that is so clear to me, and the reason why a lot of claims don't get put in, it's because nobody's cutting any offensive linemen that are really worth being in the 2 or 3 deep. I hear that from more teams across the league, especially when you start to get toward the end of a training camp tour and they're asking you, hey, where have you been? Who have you talked to? Who have you seen? And then they'll say, have you heard anybody's going to cut a lineman? Because they want to instantly assess whether or not they can add that lineman.
And by the way, Dan Skipper is getting cut by the Lions, but Dan Skipper has enough tenure. He's not going through waivers. So they probably have their wink-wink where he comes right back.
Yeah, he'll be right back. He'll be in a hotel, and then once that's over, he comes out of the hotel and he comes to the facility.
Back to his own house.
But back to his own house. Yeah, that's right. You're right. I always say that, right. I'm thinking in my mind the hotel. But it's just that's the one takeaway I would always say is pay close attention to how many waiver claims your team puts in, because if it's a lot, your roster churn is still happening. And that's why Carolina, as you said, Andrew, Carolina put in so many claims last year. It's because Dan Morgan, as they were churning the bottom of that roster, they were looking at a 53 man that, you know, in 2 or 3 years was probably going to be 85% turned over in Dan Morgan's third year as a general manager.
Yeah, Frank,
I left Frank speechless.
Right?
No, yes.
Finally, James Carville in old school. You did it perfectly. I have nothing to add. Any team that any of the three of us has covered that's even decent just grinds over like the 54th, 53rd. How can we get rid of this second year linebacker? Because they like them a lot more than the rest of the NFL does. That's why the whole like keeping 4 quarterbacks is a big deal, because these front offices are like, oh, we can't possibly get rid of this receiver because somebody might claim him. And so, yes, if somebody's claiming 6 guys, it ain't a good sign, because every other team in the league is like, oh, my God, we have 58 guys we want to keep. And how do we get them all to the practice squad? Yeah, that's just how it goes with every single team.
In our final minute here, like, I'm going through the list of the 27 that were claimed a year ago. I'll just give you the 7 claimed by the Panthers. Tariq Castro-Field, Shamar Bartholomew, Keenan Isaac, Lonnie Johnson, Jarrett Kingston, John Rattigan, Jamie Sheriff. So those are the 7. those are the seven taken by the team with the number one priority. So just keep that in mind. Now, that player might be significant to any of those 32. They want to keep them. Sure, obviously. But you know what? Just a little perspective ahead of cutdown day tomorrow. Also perspective, we are back tomorrow, 6:30 Eastern time, after rosters are cut down. That is Charles Robinson. My name is Frank that is Frank Schwab. I'm sorry. I'm not Frank Schwab. Sorry, Frank. I'm Andrew.
Okay.
You're Frank.
I'm honored.
Who am I? What? See you tomorrow.